From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, concerns over poor medical care at Immigration and Customs Enforcement's Northlake Detention Center.
Here she says that a nurse was really cruel to her and told her that the only way she would go to a hospital is if she was missing a limb, a finger, an arm, or a leg.
Then a heartfelt novel about rural romance and life choices in the UP.
Once you get to know the individual and see them as more than just their stereotype, they become real and something that you can engage with on a personal level.
And a Points North episode about raw sewage and threats to the Great Lakes.
You just see all the water that was coming in the tunnel now going to the lake and to the rivers.
Those stories and more coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, some big problems with aging sewer systems. These problems aren't limited to metro areas like Detroit.
Do every damn thing you can to stop an overflow. Do everything you can to improve stormwater runoff and everything you can to make sure the plants treat the wastewater the way they're supposed to.
That's coming up in a bit, but first, Michigan is home to the largest immigration detention center in the Midwest. There are more than 1,400 immigrants on average detained each day at the Northlake Processing Center in Baldwin, north of Big Rapids. The vast majority of these folks do not have a criminal record. Average length of stays has been running about 45 days. Since the shuttered prison reopened as an immigrant detention facility last year, there has been one recorded death. Nenko Ganchev lived in Chicago for 30 years after immigrating from Bulgaria. Federal officials say that he was found unresponsive on the floor of his cell at Northlake. Immigration and Customs Enforcement said they suspect the death was from natural causes, but it does remain under investigation. Democrats in Congress have been asking for answers about the medical care at Northlake. So far, they've not gotten any response from the Department of Homeland Security. This week, two of Michigan's congressional representatives, Democrats Haley Stevens and Hillary Skolton, visited the facility.
He spoke of being, you know, kept in a freezing room where he couldn't feel his toes and, you know, having his food just thrown into his cell. So these are things that we really need to take seriously.
While they were able to talk with one detainee there, they were not allowed to speak with him in private. Stateside producer Michelle Jokishpolo has been able to talk candidly with several people at Northlake, and she visited the center again this week. She checks in with us now for an update. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, April.
So for those who have not been to Northlake, do you mind just starting off by telling us what it feels like to walk in?
Yeah, so when you enter Northlake, you have to put everything, you know, that you own in your car. You have to leave it in the car, except maybe your car keys. And you have to put the rest of your items, like your car keys, in a locker. You go through TSA-like check-in. And then a guard will lead you through a long hallway, kind of around the center of the facility. And then once you enter the visiting room, you know, there's rows of small tables where you are met with the folks that you're visiting with. You have a period of time that you can meet with them. Every time that I've been, the time has varied. So the guards will lead the individual you're meeting with there, and you'll have the chance to talk to them. You can't bring any paper in or any recording device or pen or anything like that. So all you really have is your memory when you walk in.
Gosh. Who have you met with as you've been visiting there?
Yeah, this past week I met with Dalvelis Pineda. She's 26 years old. She has a son, a five-year-old. She's from Chicago, and she was arrested when she showed up for work at Walmart last October. So she's been there since then. And she told me that, you know, one day in the middle of the night, about 2 weeks after she got in there, she started to feel this really, really bad pain in her tooth that radiated to the whole right side of her face. She described the pain as a 10 out of 10, but she was not allowed to see a doctor until the very next day. They told her that, you know, in order to see a doctor, she had to fill out this form at 7:30 in the morning, and that's when she would see somebody. The pain was initially treated with ibuprofen, and they told her to do salt and water gargles. And that's despite the fact that she had told officials when she got there that she was scheduled to get that tooth pulled out, you know, with her regular dentist in Chicago. But they didn't manage to do that until about a month after she had complained about her tooth pain. And what was really interesting to me is she said, you know, throughout this process, there was a point that they even scheduled her to see a psychologist because they thought she was like making this pain up. And when she met with, you know, the therapist, she's like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, I don't think you can help me. This is a tooth pain. I've also been able to speak with Michelle Barrios. She's from Venezuela, like Tal Bailis. She was arrested here in Detroit. Before that, she was living in Ohio. And when she was arrested, she told officials that she was being treated at home for a lump in her breast, and she was scheduled to have more exams done. She says she feels the lump on her breast, and the pain feels like it's burning. It's so bad, she can't really sleep at night. She's been super anxious. When I speak with her, she cries pretty easily because she's worried that something might be wrong with her. You know, she worries that it could be cancer, and she says that she has visited the doctor at Northlake dozens of times and asked to get imaging done, but that hasn't happened yet. This is what she said. Here she says that a nurse was really cruel to her and told her that the only way she would go to a hospital is if she was missing a limb, a finger, an arm, or a leg. And she says that made her really mad because it's not fair that they're keeping her there, not just for her, but everyone there, because she says there are many women there who are sick and are not receiving the care they need. During her time at Northlake, Michelle has passed out twice. Both times she was taken in a gurney to the healthcare facilities on site and was ultimately told that there was nothing wrong with her except for dehydration. And since arriving, all she's received is antibiotics, ibuprofen, and Pepcid. I will say from everyone I've spoken with, the main thing they're treated with is water, antibiotics, or Tylenol.
Michelle, have you been able to verify some of the medical claims that you've heard?
That's a really hard part because the folks at Geo Group, that's the company that owns the detention center, say they're not authorized to share detainees' medical information with members of the media. But when it came to Dalvelis, she's the woman with the tooth pain, she sent me her partner sent me a screenshot he took while video calling her from the facility, and the screenshot shows her swollen cheek. And she said, you know, that was because of the tooth pain. It's also worth noting that the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, filed a federal lawsuit last October on behalf of several detainees. And the suit is alleging, among other claims, that one man diagnosed with leukemia has been unable to receive necessary treatment while in custody. According to, you know, Geo Group website and the ICE press releases that we've seen, people who are in custody are able to receive medical, dental, mental health care while there. They have screenings within 12 hours of arriving at the detention facility. They have a full health assessment within 14 days of arriving, and they have access to medical appointments 24 hours, 7 days of the week. And they state that at no time during detention is a person denied emergency care.
From the people you have been able to talk to, did you notice any patterns when it comes to the medical treatment that they have received and delays?
You know, like I mentioned, it seems like when they have issues, they are treated with Tylenol and water. So far, they have told me that they have to fill out a form early in the morning to get care. If they don't, they won't be able to see a health care provider. The visits are translated, and I've also gathered that if there is an emergency situation, it can take up to 20 minutes for that care to be offered or an ambulance called. The folks I have talked to said they don't feel confident that they would be okay if something serious medically happened to them because of the care and services available to them and how some of the guards treat them or take their complaints seriously.
How do staff typically respond when these people have spoken up about pain or worsening symptoms?
Yeah, it really depends on the person and the staff that is there. Some folks have told me, Dalvaili's told me that, you know, the guards have overall been nice to them. And there was one guard that even gave her some of her own Tylenol to help with her tooth pain. But then there are other folks who have a much harder time receiving care. They have felt dismissed, laughed at, or like Michelle, even the nurse said that comment to her that made her feel like there was nothing she could do to get the care she needed.
What sticks with you from this latest visit that you made to North Lake?
You know, visiting there is really hard. Sometimes I feel really powerless, and I feel like there doesn't seem like there's a way for detainees to seek accountability when they're not receiving the appropriate medical care. And, you know, unless they have money for a lawyer or have family who can call the facility nonstop asking for that help, they're kind of left on their own.
Michelle Jokish-Polo is a producer with Stateside. She's also been reporting on North Lake for the Michigan Public Newsroom. Michelle, thank you so much.
Of course. Thanks, April.
What's on your mind these days? We do love hearing from you, especially if there's a story or question we might be able to tackle. Anything specific to elections that you're curious about? What's the Michigan road trip you're most looking forward to taking this year? You can drop an email. The address is stateside@michiganpublic.org. Or maybe you'd rather leave a message on social media for us. We'll see it if you post on the Michigan Public Facebook page. Or you can also DM us on Instagram or TikTok. Our handles on both of those platforms are @MichiganPublic. We're going to take a breath now and pause for just a moment. After that, a novel about a guy and a girl figuring it out on a sheep farm in the Upper Peninsula.
So I grew up on a farm. We had sheep and we have cattle. And I was a lifelong 4-H'er and I showed animals, just about every animal you can show at the fair, I showed at the fair.
Writer Sarah Moore has published her first novel. We're going to talk to her about it next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you prefer your fiction romantic with a dose of animal husbandry, laced with incidents of rams hanging out at the corner bar, and coated with the papery chaff that settles on your skin while baling hay, we've got one for you. Sarah Maurer's debut novel, A Good Animal, is the story of Everett, a farm kid who lives not too far from Sault Ste. Marie, and Mary, a girl who's never gathered very much moss, who comes to Everett's community and sends his heart on a rocket ride. Their story is all about reconciling conflicting energies and future plans with their mutual attraction. Does a rural romance have to end with one partner's compromise? Sarah Maurer lives in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and she joins us now. Sarah, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, April. Thank you so much for having me. I'm just thrilled.
So I've been trying to remember the last time I read a story like this from a guy's perspective. How did Everett Lint become your lens for the story of Everett and Mary?
Everett didn't really give me too much of a choice. He came to me very fully formed. The very first scene I wrote for this novel was very clearly from his point of view. And I knew it was about this kid who raises sheep and sees everything through the lens of a sheep farmer. And there was a little bit of humor in that and just honesty and goodness. And I knew that's the lens for the book.
Yeah. Sheep farming, was this a subject of personal experience for you?
Yes. So I grew up on a farm. We had sheep and we have cattle, and I was a lifelong 4-H-er, and I showed animals, just about every animal you can show at the fair, I showed at the fair. And I have had my own very small flock, but I gave them all to my sister, and she has them now, and my parents still farm. They have a cattle farm in Sault Ste. Marie as well.
The life is certainly full of beauty, but also is way less pastoral than I think some people might imagine for sheep farming. And this is a lesson that Everett's little sister, Katie, is learning in some difficult ways for a lamb who becomes a ewe named Fluff, who she truly loves and she feels more for as a pet than as livestock. You know, Everett's not romantic about his sheep. It's not that he feels nothing for them, but he doesn't see them as pets, or has, you know, it's been a long time since he felt that way about them. And it's not so much that his own perspective on the sheep is changing because his sister feels, you know, love for them, but it's more that he's trying to sort of mediate between the, you know, her more tender feelings and what he understands is the realities. Do you think a lot of farmers feel that way?
I think a lot of farmers view their livestock as crops, as products. If you look at them as like a herd, or a flock, it's very easy to not see them as individuals. But when you've got one that has sought you out, sees you as a mother or a father, as a life giver, who comes to you, that you establish this personal relationship with, it's very, very difficult to see them in that way. But I think what's unique about Everett is he is at an age and a time of his life where he is almost he's at a crossroads where he can, at the center of a bridge, maybe, where he can look back and see where he came from and look forward and see where he wants to go. And he can recognize what Katie's feeling. And he has moments where he remembers his own experiences feeling that way too, and how he wished someone would have talked him through those experiences. And he tries to do that for Katie.
So the very first time Everett lays eyes on Mary, who is going to become very important to him, he thinks about her eyes looking like the eyes of a ewe. Not that they're beautiful like a sheep's eyes, but that she's appraising him. And I wondered, he doesn't vocalize this, but I wondered so much what Mary would have thought of that comparison in the moment.
She would have not liked it one bit. And she says that to him at one point, that she did not even like him when she first met him, because she thinks he's this hick, this small town kid. And initially, Everett's best friend, Charlie, thinks the opposite of her, that she's this snooty city girl who's come to town, just wants to leave. But again, once you get to know the individual and see them as more than just their stereotype, they become real and something that you can engage with on a personal level. And I think that's the same with the animals, like we talked about earlier. It's all about personal connections and seeing somebody or something for what it is.
This is probably a good moment to talk about your setting. This is a book about the UP, but it's certainly not set in a swamp or in a national forest land. I wonder, do you mind reading the prologue of the book for us?
So, the prologue. Sault Ste. Marie. When I walk these fields, I feel generations beside me. All those lints bending over this wet clay soil, putting their hands in it, their shovels and seeds, their sweat. They pulled stones from the land to set the foundations for the house I live in now. They saw these same rose-colored skies glowing over the St. Mary's River in the morning, the same June grass poking up bleached and dry through the crusted snow. They walk beside me, and I tell them what's on my mind. I tell them my plans for the farm, the price of hay and show lambs. I tell them about my wife and daughter. But mostly, I talk to them about Mary. I tell them about those 9 months we had, screwing to beat hell, driving my piece of shit Ford with roads and roads before us, gravel jumping up and biting the undercarriage, dust flying up behind, I tell them about that cold May night when Mary stared out my truck window, far away and unreachable, with the St. Mary's churning behind her like it's done for 10,000 years. They were there that night. They saw everything, and they're the only ones I can tell it to.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Can I just ask you a little bit again about this land, farmland, that is a part of the geography in the UP, and what effect that land has on you and has had on you?
I remember doing a writing prompt when I was very young, and it was name the place where you feel the most yourself. And I just wrote a single word, and it was field. And it's these fields around my mom and dad's house where the cows and the sheep have always grazed. And I just, whenever I'm there, I just feel so connected and rooted to my family and to this place. And I knew that was going to be a pivotal part of this book.
So it's important to Everett for reasons that we can hear in that passage, but it's also important to you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Again, when I was little, I think my childhood is just so intricately braided with the farmland around Sault Ste. Marie. I took a little plastic Fisher-Price table and pulled it out to the field, and I brought a little chair and a notebook, and that's where I wrote my very first poem. And my Aunt Susie called it my writing spot. And I just think it's so connected to my writing process. Yeah, very important to me.
I want to talk a little bit about Mary. She is someone who, again, has moved around a lot, and she has aspirations for art school. And beyond that, she's not really sure which way her life is going. What do you think she sees in Everett? As you mentioned, like, she wasn't much on him when she first met him.
No. He grows on her. And, you know, she does say, you know, she thinks he's cute. But I think for her, it's a groundedness, someone who is so certain of what they want, of where they live, the consistency and deep love that's in his family that she sometimes feels is lacking in her own. But mostly, I think what she sees in him is this person who is seen and recognized not only by the people around him, but the creatures around him, because all of the sheep know him and trust him as well. And, you know, she's bounced around a lot for her whole life and is always seen as the new person, but never for who she really is. And for the first time through him, she feels acknowledged and seen.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with writer Sarah Maurer about her debut novel, A Good Animal. It's set on a sheep farm in the UP. We are seeing this story through Everett's eyes, but, you know, Mary has this dilemma. And I really appreciated the fact that the story gives equal weight to both Mary's dilemma, like, do I want to stay with this guy and put down roots here, or do I want to go follow my bliss? And also Everett's dilemma about whether he wants to be involved with her. That seems like a very intentional choice to you know, give both of them their moment of wrestling.
I think the thing I was really exploring was my own discomfort with being someone who was from this rural place and had left, as most rural kids feel this pressure when they're graduating high school to leave, go out, make something of themselves, achieve something. And I internalized that. I'm like, yes, I can't wait to leave Sault Ste. Marie. And, you know, I went downstate for school. My husband and I lived in Metro Detroit for a long time. And then when we had kids, we wanted to move back and raise them by family. And we were able to work remotely. So it all worked out. Life was good. But then after a while, I started feeling like those internalized feelings of like that hometown girl who's come back or somebody who's never left. And I felt like the stigma. And I don't know, I there was this very poignant moment where I was like signing up for Facebook and I had to like enter in current city and hometown. And I realized they would both be the same. And I was like, oh my God, I cannot put the same
people are going to think I'm just this one person.
Yeah. And but I was like, why am I so uncomfortable with that? And I just really wanted to play with that tension that rural people feel, that pressure to leave, and think about, okay, turning that around, what does that say about the people who are actually, who do stay, who form their lives in these rural communities? By encouraging people to leave, are we saying that the people who stay have less value or their choices aren't as valuable? So it was really important to me to create a character who wanted to stay.
There are a couple of kinds of discussions about heartbreak in this book. Romantic heartbreak, heartbreak of growing up a little bit. And also, I mean, I kind of feel like the heartbreaks of the farm life, because, yeah. I mean, that it is not an easy life. And there are setbacks, and some of them are just crushing. Is there one or another of these that feel more primary to you in Everett and Mary's story?
Everett, from the beginning, knows Mary doesn't want to stay. And he knows that, and he still pursues her. And he refuses to engage with the fact that she doesn't want to be there throughout the story until the very last page. But something has to make him realize it. And I think the same is true, like with our animals. We raise them and we know what's going to happen with them, but we push it aside, we compartmentalize it until the very moment we can't compartmentalize it anymore. And I just really wanted to lift that and show people a somewhat non-idealized version of farm life, so they do know the sacrifices that are behind everything.
Having made the decision that the story was going to come at us from Everett's perspective, did his view of things take you in some directions you didn't expect as you worked your way through the story?
I think what it revealed to me writing through Everett's perspective is how growing up with animals and constantly evaluating them for their reproductive qualities or their breed standard, how they might do in a show ring, what sort of cuts of meat they might produce. It was surprising to me to inhabit that point of view and then apply it to a love interest in a way. Just the way that point of view just permeated his entire worldview, so that even as he was like interacting with girls, because Mary's not the only one he interacts with, but he's constantly evaluating in like this carcass quality point of view, which kind of sounds funny, but it was a trajectory for me to think about, okay, then in a wider perspective, how does that affect how he or other people like him interpret women and their reproductive rights as a whole? And I think, you know, if your entire life focus is on reproduction, than someone who maybe doesn't want to reproduce or follow the same type of lifestyle that you have adhered to, it'd be really challenging for you to try and just understand that. And I think Mary is that challenging force in his life and really makes him see things in a new way.
Sarah Maurer's debut novel is called A Good Animal. She's going to be launching her publication at Lake State on February 24th with an evening event. She'll be at Schuller's in Grand Rapids on March 19th, and you can find her at the Bookman in Grand Haven on March 18th. Sarah, thank you so much for talking with us, and congratulations. The book's really lovely.
Thank you so much, April. I loved it.
Sense of place is such a big thing with us here in Michigan. I mean, it's true for writers like Sarah, as we heard. It's true for all of us in all the places we live. Whether you're in mid-Michigan or you live in Detroit, Marquette, or Grand Rapids, You definitely have some special things about where you live and what you experience there. In recent weeks, we've been thinking an awful lot about our lived experience of politics. Did you hear the latest episode of our spinoff podcast, On Hand, in which we told the story of Jackson, Michigan, where several thousand anti-slavery advocates came together in a big field under the trees to found the Republican Party? What about you? Have you had a brush with Michigan political greatness? Maybe your uncle went to meetings with Malcolm X, or you traded tweets with John Dingell. Send us your politics stories. The address is onhand@umich.edu. We'd love to share your stories about what makes this place unique. Drop us a line. It's time for a quick break now. When we get back, what happens when rainstorms get too big for the sewage system to handle?
You just see all the water that was coming in the tunnel now going to the lake and to the rivers.
That's in just a minute. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. I want to lay out the following two choices for you. Either flood a bunch of basements or send raw sewage into the Great Lakes. Not a lot of good options there. What would you do? That's the central question of the latest episode of Points North from Interlochen Public Radio. Here's podcast host Dan Wanshura.
This is a story about a guy named Kevin Schaefer. He's obsessed with rain. That's because he oversees the sewage and flood management in Milwaukee. And when I say sewage, I'm talking pretty gross stuff. Pee, poop, the water from your shower, the sour milk you pour down the drain. In other words, it's Kevin's job to make sure that sewage soup ends up in treatment plants and not in rivers, Lake Michigan, or people's basements. So it makes sense Kevin is obsessed with rain. Every morning at 6 o'clock, he checks his inbox for this detailed weather forecast.
I look at it even on weekends.
It predicts the amount of rain for that day and the next seven. So in August 2025, on a Saturday, he opens this email and he finds out the expected rainfall for the day isn't much. It's less than half an inch. It's pretty similar for the next day, too.
I thought, okay, we're fine. That's not much rain. If we're less than 2 inches, I don't worry about it too much.
Kevin continues with his Saturday. Eventually, he and his family end up at a pizza joint for dinner. They get seated, start eating, and it's here, during their meal, Kevin looks outside and notices it's pouring, like buckets of rain.
It was a, kind of a shock because based on the forecast we'd received that morning, we would have been fine. So I was a little surprised.
Kevin's got a classic Midwest vibe, pretty understated. So when he says he was a little surprised, what he really means is
scared, shocked, mad.
That's because heavy rain can overwhelm the sewer system, and it could overflow. And that could mean billions of gallons of sewage dumped into Milwaukee's waterways. They finish dinner. Kevin gets the car, gets totally soaked, by the way, picks up his wife and kids, and heads home.
I think my wife would tell you I kind of get in this zone where I don't talk a whole lot because I'm already thinking about what I got to do. So it was probably a pretty quiet drive home. And as I'm driving down to my house and I could see the clouds over the downtown area, I thought, yeah, this is not good.
Because that rainstorm is quickly turning into what's called a 1,000-year storm. The chances of it happening in a given year is 1 in 1,000.
We got in the house, and I just went immediately to the office, turned on the computer. I get on the phone. I call our outreach person and say, okay, I think we're going to have a problem tonight. Just be ready for it.
And it's Kevin's job as the head of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District to figure out what to do next. All right, so if you're like me, you might not be an expert on city sewer systems, but they're kind of cool. Say you flush something down the toilet. That waste goes from your house to the sewer, which is a pipe. Then the sewage flows to a bigger sewer, which empties into larger ones, all the way down the line until it reaches the wastewater treatment plant. There, the water gets cleaned and delivered back to, in this case, Lake Michigan. But the amount of wastewater Kevin has to deal with isn't always the same, especially if there's a lot of rain and stormwater runoff. So Milwaukee has this backup system. It's called the Deep Tunnel.
All right, we're going down. You might just want to watch your shoulder.
Okay.
We get in an elevator and go 300 feet underground. The Deep Tunnel is basically this giant holding tank underneath the normal sewer system.
Yeah, so we're at the downstream end of the Deep Tunnel. So all the water flows to this point and then we pump it up.
The Deep Tunnel can hold 521 million gallons of water. The whole system is over 28 miles long.
This is a pump unit and this is a pump unit. And so when the pumps come on, they'll take that water and they'll pump it up 330 feet and it goes right into the primary treatment system. So then it's all treated before it goes to the lake. If the pumps were on right now, we'd be yelling because they're very loud. We're lucky they're not on right now.
When there's a big rainstorm, Kevin can take pressure off the regular sewer system by routing stormwater and sewage here in the Deep Tunnel. That prevents a sewage backup into homes and businesses or an overflow into the environment.
And it's not too smelly.
No. See, I told you. Everyone goes, oh, it must stink. I go, well, I don't smell it. So, you know.
But sometimes the Deep Tunnel fills all the way up. And when that happens, Kevin has one option, a sewage overflow. That means pathogens like bacteria and viruses spilling into rivers and even Lake Michigan. Stuff like E. coli and Salmonella.
Dr. Sandra McClellan is a researcher with Milwaukee's Great Lakes Water Institute.
And we really want to get at how long is that bacteria staying in the water column and how long is it a threat to the beaches.
And if there's one thing Kevin hates, it's a sewage overflow.
You've got a watershed with 1.1 million people, and they're expecting perfection. They want everything to work. So you do what you can, but you know that you're limited, and you put everything into it.
He chokes up for a minute, which kind of catches me off guard.
So anyway, you got to cut all this out.
I don't know that everybody has that level of care.
So back to that huge storm in August. It's Saturday night, and things are getting more tense.
So it's Kevin sitting in his underwear at a computer at home, writing on a pad of paper these numbers and going, oh, okay. What are we going to do?
He's hoping for good news on the radar, that the rain will stop, but it just keeps coming. The Deep Tunnel is filling up fast, and that's when it hits him.
I was probably on the phone from like 9 o'clock on, just talking about how the system was reacting, where the flows were coming from, and you just see it coming higher and higher. And so you say, okay, we're going to have an overflow.
Around 10 o'clock that night, he gives the command for a sewage overflow.
You just see all the water that was coming in the tunnel now going to the lake and to the rivers.
And before Kevin's night is over, it's actually going to get even worse. Historically, the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District didn't have a lot of fans. It had a bad reputation. Until the early 90s, the city was notorious for sewage overflows. Almost every time it rained, there was an overflow.
We had carp, and that was about the only fish that would live in our rivers. Everything else was dead.
Kevin says the habitat along the rivers was pretty gnarly, too. It got contaminated with lots of industrial waste.
It was an open sewer, basically, because, you know, 365 days a year, and you're having overflows 50 to 60 of those days, you know, that's not good.
We're talking like 8 to 9 billion gallons of sewage and stormwater a year. And the sewerage district was getting the blame. residents were not happy. But when the Clean Water Act became law in 1972, Milwaukee and a bunch of other cities had to find a fix.
Clean Water Act passed, and all of a sudden you went from, okay, it's okay to have as many as you want, to, whoop, you gotta stop them.
Milwaukee's solution to this problem was to build that deep tunnel, again, that giant underground holding tank. They built it in 1993, and it worked. Instead of 50 to 60 overflows a year, the deep tunnel cut that number down to less than 6, which was the limit imposed by the Environmental Protection Agency. Kevin says the deep tunnel was never built to completely stop overflows from happening. It was built as more of a water quality tunnel to help capture the most toxic pollutants during that first big flush of surface runoff. Then the overflow into waterways would be mostly rainwater.
What we saw was almost immediate improvement in the water quality in the rivers. There was not the stuff floating in the rivers that we had before. We saw fish reviving in the waterways. So it was spectacular to see nature respond to this cleaning effort.
But what wasn't immediate was a change in people's feelings about the sewerage district. They had paid a lot of money for this new deep tunnel, and they didn't get why overflows were still happening. The reality is, some of the overflows couldn't be avoided, but some actually could. That's because back then, the deep tunnel was operated by an algorithm, and it just wasn't very accurate. Sometimes the algorithm would trigger an overflow when the tunnel wasn't even full.
So we'd have an overflow, the tunnel would be half full, and the rain would stop. And then the next day, the media was all over. It's like, you still had half the tunnel. Why did you have an overflow?
But since the sewerage district was still well under that 6 overflow limit each year, it didn't really worry about a few here and there. The mindset of the agency was, there used to be 60 of these a year. Now it's less than 6. No big deal, right?
There was a lot of scrutiny placed on the district through that time period.
So much scrutiny that when Kevin became the executive director of the sewerage district in 2002, he got a new nickname.
I walked down the train on Amtrak heading to Chicago one day, and they go, oh, there's the dumper.
Somebody said that?
Oh, yeah. I'm like, hi, I'm the dumper. Yeah.
One of the very first things Kevin did when he became executive director in 2002 was to replace the faulty algorithm that controlled the deep tunnel. And he replaced it with himself.
I said, well, if we're going to be blamed for an overflow, I'm going to be the one that makes the decision. I'm not going to let the algorithm run it.
Kevin didn't really know what he was getting into, but now he does. It means late nights watching radar, chugging coffee, and sweating it out about 8 to 10 times a year. It's all on his shoulders now.
If we're going to get blamed for the overflow, I'm going to be the one making that decision because I'm the one that's going to be in the cameras the next day.
When Kevin deals with a sewage overflow, there's kind of a priority list he runs through in his head. Homes first, businesses second, the environment third.
To see people walking around in their basements that are full of sewage, it's a severe public health risk, and I will protect the public first choice every time. I don't want to sacrifice the environment for that, but knowing what I know about the quality of the water that's going to come out from an overflow, I'll do more to protect the homes and the businesses than I will the environment at that point.
Now it's the early morning hours between 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock. That huge August storm just keeps on going. And right in the middle of it, Kevin watches as another, even bigger rain system rolls through and dumps on Milwaukee. He was hoping the water treatment plants would be able to catch up, but that's not going to happen. Around 3 in the morning, Kevin makes the call to close some other sewers leading to the deep tunnel. It's filled to the brim with 521 million gallons of sewage and stormwater runoff. From that point on, anything entering the sewer system is headed for the Milwaukee River and Lake Michigan. It's his only option.
It's one of those times where, okay, you've done everything you can. Everything's still working, but the Mother Nature just came in with too much. So at that point, you're just holding on, waiting for the rain to stop.
Around 5 in the morning, Kevin finally heads to bed, tries to get a little sleep. Later that morning, the Milwaukee mayor's office calls a press conference. Kevin's supposed to be there. He hops in his truck, but gets stuck in traffic. He finds out the highway is flooded. He ends up listening to the press conference on the radio.
We had 14 inches of rain in this location right here, which is an intense amount in a short period of time. So there's no sewer system across the country that can maintain that amount. So
city engineers, they got up there and said, you know, we're not built for this type of storm. This type of storm is one that you don't ever want to live through. And unfortunately, we did.
As we start moving forward and the rain starts to dissipate, it'll start going out. So, I mean, I know I had water in my basement. I'm pretty sure a lot of the folks behind me had water in their basements. It's just the amount of volume that came so fast. It's an intensity issue.
Whenever there's an overflow, Kevin is always concerned about what the public is going to think.
Sometimes the aftermath of the storm is worse than the storm.
But the overall response to this overflow is different.
Everyone kind of understood that, you know, this is a big storm.
Backed up basements, raging rivers, and cars floating, even underwater on state highways. The damage from the weekend storm is widespread. The Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District says it could have been even worse without 28 miles of storage buried underground, known as the deep tunnels. Think of that.
There was more than $33 million in damage to Milwaukee and surrounding areas from the storm. State officials reported 1,500 homes were destroyed or had major damage due to flooding. And over 5 billion gallons of sewage overflowed into rivers in Lake Michigan as a result of the storm. But despite all that, the overflow was mostly rainwater, so there weren't any fish die-offs or any other long-term environmental impacts that we know of. And Kevin Schaefer and the sewerage district get a lot of credit for that. Now they're recognized nationally as leaders in sewage and flood management. Thanks to projects like the Deep Tunnel, the sewerage district has captured and cleaned over 98% of all the stormwater and wastewater that's entered the system since 1994. The goal nationally is way less, 85%. Besides the deep tunnel, part of that success is because Milwaukee has replaced concrete water channels with natural landscapes. There are more green roofs, and some residents even have rain buckets. All things that can absorb and capture stormwater before it gets to the sewers. And that's all because of Kevin's vision. When I was interviewing Kevin, I noticed this incredible wood carving of a mallard duck decoy in his office. He got it last year. It's a National Conservation Achievement Award from Ducks Unlimited.
Kevin's really been forward thinking and taking more of a watershed approach to everything. The big tunnel is one solution, but another solution is to get out in the watershed and catch the water up in basins scattered throughout the landscape.
Brian Glenzinski works in conservation with Ducks Unlimited. And now, the sewerage district averages just over 2 overflows a year.
I think a lot of that is this ethic of do every damn thing you can to stop an overflow. Do everything you can to improve stormwater runoff and everything you can to make sure the plants treat the wastewater the way they're supposed to.
Kevin and the sewerage district have gone from being known as the polluter of the waterways to the protector, but it's come at a cost.
I'm very emotional about this, and I think there is a impact to me. And so I've told folks as a joke, I said, yeah, I'm going to have therapy for PTSD to just recover from some of this. And as you saw, it's going to impact me. And I wish I had it controlled, but 24 years later, I'm still as emotional as I was before. I want to live in a place that's as clean as it can be, as natural as it can be.
Reporting from Dan Wanshura and the Points North podcast at Interlochen Public Radio. That's all for Stateside for today. Our show's producers are Mike Blank, Ronia Cabansag, Michelle Jokish-Polo, and April Van Buren. Our senior producer is Mercedes Mejia, and the executive producer of Stateside is Laura Weber-Davis. Our interns are Molly Anderson, Astrid Code, and Maximilian Resch. Stateside is a production of Michigan Public. You can find out more about our work at michiganpublic.org. We're a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. We are so glad to have you listening along. I'm April Baer. Have a safe weekend, and we'll see you Monday.